The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Nick Frank. I'm one of the owners of Frank Brothers Guitar Company, and I'm joined by my good pal and co-host, Aaron Goff of Goff Custom Knives. What's happening?
You're improvising there. I thought we agreed not to do that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like jazz, you know?
You can't be trusted. Yeah, it's going good, man. It's going good. It's been a crazy day. I feel like I never have enough time.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm always behind on something.
Yeah.
How about you?
I can relate to that. I can very much relate to that. I had one of those like good, flowy, productive days. So I feel all right.
Nice.
Some highs and lows, as per usual.
Yes, I had a couple of those too. So I think I said to you last week that the fixtures that I made for doing the kitchen knife suck. Mm-hmm. They're bad. They're the worst fixtures I've made in a long time.
Oh, God.
Basically the second operation, there's an air gap underneath the pot, which I thought was necessary because I wasn't going to surface the whole top of the stock. And I wasn't surfacing the whole top of the stock because there are bolts like in the way. I couldn't, holding down the stock. But that means that it just builds up resonance in that part, and I get like catastrophic tool failure very quickly.
Right.
Overheating of the part, it was just bad. So anyway, today I went to take the fixture has like a sub plate, a base plate, and then which is 1 inch thick aluminum, and then it has these steel sections that are pinned and bolted into place. Mm-hmm. And I went to remove the Op 2 one to put a new raw piece of material on there so I could remake that fixture. And I used my impact gun. I was like, oh, yeah. But I always use ball head hex driver bits in my impact gun, just because I use it mainly for on my fixture plate. Like, I have a lot of quarter 20 fasteners on the fixture plate, so it makes it really fast. The only problem is I should have remembered that those ball head drivers, you can shear the ball off in the bolt. And in this case, I used stainless steel hardware in the back of the thing. So the head of the bolt was soft enough that the ball kind of turned halfway in between the flats of the hex.
It got wedged.
And then sheared off. So I had this ball head stuck in there. I took like a ratchet and removed all the rest of them. It was fine, but that one was like, I tried to get the ball head out of the socket on the fastener, and no go. I ended up having to. There's a fantastic trick that I read about on Practical Machinist. Basically, you take a nut from a fastener that's a little bit larger than what you're trying to remove. You lay that over the hole so you can see the head of the fastener through the hole in your nut. And then you fill the hole of the nut with weld.
Oh.
You actually weld through.
Crazy.
Yeah. And so you're basically welding the nut onto the top of the fastener underneath. And then you can use the nut as a handle to undo it. And it worked beautifully.
Wow. That is clever.
Yeah, it was. I can't take credit for that. Someone else came up with it, but oh my god, did it work beautifully? So that was my ups and downs. I was like, oh god damn, and then I was like, yeah, I fixed it.
I also snapped something off in a hole today. Oh. Well, similarly to what you've done.
Did you have to go to hospital or?
No, I was. You know what I did is I was taking a clamping call off, and it's got two. The guitar has two holes. They've got two steel bushings, and until we fully we need to update the placement of these holes in the fixture. But anyways, we have two dowel pins that we're currently using to locate the guitar body onto these gluing calls that go into the gluing call has the guitar has the steel bushings, the gluing call just has the holes.
Right.
Anyways, we're using these phenolic dowels, and as I was lifting it off, it kind of got stuck, and I just twisted it, and it just sheared the phenolic dowel off into the call perfectly flush with the call too. So now what I did though is I looked at it and I was like, I don't need this right now. Just put it back on the shelf. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I'll fix it later. I'm just gonna drill a hole in it and then tap that with probably a wood screw and then just yoink it out. But it felt good to just put it back on the shelf and be like, I'm not going to deal with this right now.
This is a problem for future Nick.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck you, future Nick.
That guy. And yeah, otherwise, what was my high was we tested out this new program on the Haas. So we're cutting out the signature model, which is our double bound model. So our arcade model is like a solid body and only has the white binding. I mean, we do lots of different kinds of binding, but it only has that trim around the border on the top of the guitar. The signature model has it on the back. And it goes all around the back. So it goes around the heel. You know, typically a guitar doesn't necessarily go all the way around the back of the guitar.
Right.
On electrics. So we do this thing with for the heel. We make a heel cap and it fits into this cavity that we machine into the back. And that becomes the binding once we cut the guitar out. That's part of the binding. But
right.
In order to machine the heel cap, we've been putting it on the axes, machining like four of them at a time, and which is fine. But it's like this other part you've got to like manufacture and stock. So this was Mark's idea. He was like, the frame of the guitar is going to be scrap after this process. Let's just glue down a piece of that binding material onto a location on the body frame and machine it right out on the guitar.
Yeah. Yeah,
and 100%. then we can knock it off, install it. We make them one at a time, but it's that good workflow. And then if we're doing, you know, tortoiseshell or black binding or white binding, you know,
right, it's right there with the rest of the guitar that has the same binding.
So the only thing I have to stock now is 1-inch by 3-inch pieces of 3/8-inch thick material.
Oh, okay. So you're taking like a rectangular piece and then cutting it into the shape of the binding that'll go.
Exactly.
In. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anyways. Gotcha.
And are you just like gluing that on top with super glue or something? And you'll
just do a couple dabs of super glue.
Nice.
It's super quick. We use this gel super glue that's really nice. So it doesn't like get everywhere.
Is it the Gorilla or is it a fast cap thing?
It's a fast cap thing.
Yeah. You guys love your fast cap glues.
We do. I mean, it just comes in a nice sized bottle. The tip, like on every super glue bottle, is horrible, but they make it long enough that you can constantly cut it back. And by the time it's like down to a nub, you're usually out of glue.
So I really like the Gorilla super glue because the cap screws on and it actually has a pin in the cap that makes a hole through the, you know, gelled up super glue.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had good luck with those not like gumming up.
Right. Okay. Does it come in various viscosities?
No, they don't have an ultra thin. They just have like a medium viscosity. However, okay. on McMaster, our favorite website, there are a line of super glues called Permabond. And I'm using some of that like water thin Permabond at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that has the same style of cap with the little pin in it.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And it works great. And it's very inexpensive.
Is it?
Yeah.
Because all super glue is expensive.
I can't remember the exact price, but I think it's like $5 a bottle or something. Like it's not okay. It's not crazy.
I wonder how much comes in a bottle.
I think it's 0.6 ounces is the one that I'm
okay.
buying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the bottles we're getting are 10 ounces and they range between like 50 and 60 Canadian dollars.
Right, right.
It ain't cheap.
No. Well,
we go through a lot.
I sent you a text the other day that so there's this fixturing method, which I saw, I think I saw it first on John Saunders' channel on NYC CNC, where on the bottom of your workpiece, you put masking tape. And then on your fixture or your spoil board or whatever, you put masking tape. And then you super glue the two pieces together, like masking tape to masking tape.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know, I was excited to see you doing this.
Yeah. And so the one of the things with the kitchen knife is that in the first operation, it makes things a lot simpler if I can just access 100% of that top surface, because that way I can just do a facing operation, cut it to thickness, and then use that plane as my Z location on the second op when I flip it over, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And I can't clamp the edges because the material's, you know, 3 inches wide and it's only an eighth of an inch thick, so it'll just flex out of the way, you know? So I was like, oh, okay, fine. I'll just try this like super glue thing. And you know, I've seen so many people say like, I love this method. Like we do crazy cuts. I've never had it move. And so I was like, okay, fuck it. I'm just going to do like full send on this. So I'm hard milling using super glue and masking tape. And I literally, as I said, I went full send. I'm like 60 inches a minute, high feed roughing, like all the stuff that I normally do. And it didn't move at all.
That's great. That's amazing.
Yeah, I was really, really impressed.
You did send me a photo and it looked awesome.
Yeah. And the thing is, because it's got that full surface contact, like you're basically getting, you know, glue over most of that surface. You know, there are probably little pockets with that glue or whatever. But that means the damping is like perfect. It's completely coupled to the machine table through the fixture, you know, like... It was great. I was super impressed.
Well, I'm sure you know this, but that's how we fixture everything on the Axis machine, except for bodies that we bolt down.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Okay. We've been doing this since we started, like 7 years ago.
Hmm.
That's how I still hold down fretboards, everything neck related.
Right.
That's how I hold down those heel caps. Before we were machining them on the Haas, everything. I mean, it's an incredible trick.
So I'm actually contemplating using this as my production fixturing for the kitchen knife. Do you have any like things that you would say that are like gotchas or like stuff to watch out for with that?
Machining tape. Like if you're cutting into the tape, gums up and mills.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pain to clean up the hardened super glue. Like if you try to pick at it, like that super glue hardens the tape and it like gets under your fingernail.
Oh, right.
It's not really smart. I don't know. Otherwise, it's just a bit of a pain, to clean.
I have
to actually
bit...
lay it down and apply it.
Yeah. So I bought some 3.5 inch wide masking tape. From McMaster, so I can just do one piece. I don't have to worry about,
because
you have to butt the edges right up next to each other.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think I have it a bit easier because my fixture and my workpiece are both steel. I can just use a razor blade to scrape it off.
Have you, like, could you literally just super glue, just use one piece of tape?
Or none. Yes, I theoretically could, and I'm tempted to try it. And I think what you would do in that case is just like, you know, take a mallet and a punch and hit it on the, like hit the workpiece on the side and like shear it off super glue.
Yeah, because that's what we do for our when we were machining our bone nuts. We don't we just tack them to onto the aluminum fixture with super glue, and then we use acetone, which is a solvent for cyanoacrylate, and that as long as it can get in and loosen the joint, it'll just like dissolve the super glue.
Yeah, I mean it's probably worth a shot. It would. I don't know whether it would make it the cleanup easier or harder. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I don't know. It might not be worth it.
Because at least the tape releases cleanly from both surfaces, and then once it comes off, you don't have any glue left. It's all on the tape. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
sweet. What about vacuum? Would vacuum work?
You know, I was looking at this, and the answer is maybe. You would have to block it in. You'd have to block the part in on all four sides, because vacuum has, so like when you remove all the air from underneath the part, then you have the air that's on top of the part pushing it down. And at sea level, that's only about 14 pounds per square inch. So over the size of this part, that would be about 500 pounds of hold down force. But the problem is it has almost no capacity to stop it from sliding.
Right. So any lateral force might push it, move it.
Which means then I'd have to put like pit bulls or like hex clamps or something.
What about dowel pins?
But the problem is imagine the dowel pin has, there's 5,000 space between the side of the workpiece and the dowel pin. It could move back and forth in that 5,000 as I'm machining it. Like it could slide around.
A 5,000 gap in your hole?
No. Imagine if you have
your tolerance.
So my stock is not going to be a perfect width always or length.
Right.
So if I have like one hard rail and then I'm putting dowel pins on the other side, I basically have to leave a gap.
I was actually talking about just like drilling right through the stock. Mm. And doing dowel pins that way.
You could, but then I have to have an op zero. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to have like a part of the cycle where I'm standing there waiting for the machine to drill the holes.
Yeah.
So yeah, you could do that. And, you know, I was thinking, oh, maybe I should do that, you know, with the super glue. I could like bolt it down or something. But you know what? If the super glue works, then like, why bother? Well,
yeah.
You know, that means that op one fixture has nothing that's specific to that knife model at all. And I love that idea. I love the idea that I could use the exact same fixture to machine a completely different type of blade.
Yeah. It's so funny because like we're desperately trying to get away from that technique. Mm. It is a powerful tool.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess for me, it's not a big deal to potentially do that because I'm only, you know, so today I went like full bore doing hard milling for the Resolute, my hunting knife, and that's three cycles in the day, you know, because each cycle's two hours and 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I had to do this for that process, then I'd only be doing super glue and tape three times in a day.
That's not bad at all.
Yeah.
I'd say that's a great way to just get the ball rolling.
Yes. Yeah, I could look into vacuum. One of the other things I could potentially do is magnetic work holding.
Oh, I've looked at this for a sweet idea. Time,
right?
Yeah.
Like, because you can get what are they called? Like the grinders, sorry, the magnets that they use on magnetic chucks. Surface grinders.
Surface grinders, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so I could do op zero on a magnetic chuck.
That's a sweet idea.
Yeah, as far as I know, the biggest issue with that is then you end up, your part gets magnetized, which isn't great, and you have chips that want to stick to it because it's magnetic.
Yes. Because I guess with grinding, you're kind of making dust.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not as big an issue.
Yeah, and also I think grinding wheels aren't very sensitive to like that dust
being
on the surface, you know, whereas a cutting tool that's encountering extra chips,
it doesn't like remachining that would suck.
Yeah.
And you maybe if you're using, I mean, an air blast or coolant, mm-hmm. but you're not.
No, I do use an air blast.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, you might have to crank the power of the air blast up. So one thing I do on Vicky, on my VMC 15, is I actually don't use compressed air from my compressor for the air blast. I actually have a separate rotary vane air pump.
Oh.
Because using compressed air from the compressor is really, really expensive.
And it's not from... Oh, because you've got... It's like a high horsepower, high CFM.
Yeah, well, low horsepower, high CFM, because it doesn't have to compress the air as much. You know, it's probably only like 20 PSI max that's coming out of this thing.
But so you're just giving it a light dusting of with air from the rotary.
Well, I would say it's probably still producing like 6 CFM, maybe.
Okay.
Five or 6 CFM. It's actually still a pretty good air blast, but that rotary vane is only like a quarter horsepower.
Wow. Yeah, this is a thing that we've got an air blast going a lot.
And you find that your compressor's on all the time because of it, right?
Well, it's not because the Haas is so much more efficient with the air. You have a nice air compressor too, but it's not going off like crazy, but it is putting a lot of air out.
Yeah, I find so on my other machine, I don't have an extra rotary vane for that machine. So I'm using air from the air compressor and I probably get about like a 50% cycle time, like duty cycle on the air compressor. It's probably running about 50% of the time to keep
right.
up. Which isn't horrible for a screw compressor, but that produces a lot of heat and like running a 10 horsepower motor for half of the day is a lot of electricity.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Yours is pretty beefy.
Yeah.
Kaiser.
So
ours is. Ours is, I think it's
7.5 or something.
Is it 7.5 or 5?
Well, I don't know. It's your compressor, buddy.
7.5. Yeah. You know, I always like go, I get really into researching something, and then as soon as I made the decision, I completely forgot all the information I learned.
yeah. Same. Yeah, so like, I don't know if I really like the rotary vanes. I'm actually looking into, there's another type of air pump called an electromagnetic air pump that they use for like hydroponic gardens.
Nice.
And for like really big aquariums. Yeah, seriously.
Sick.
And they're very inexpensive. They're like, it's like $100 for a little air pump that'll produce like 4 CFM.
Huh.
And they're like, you know, a tenth of a horsepower or something. Like,
yeah, very cool.
You know, so ultimately, like, you don't need a crazy air blast most of the time. You just need a bit of cooling and to get the chips out of the way. And you know, using too much air is really, really expensive. So like one of these little options is really nice.
That's clever. Yeah. Ours is hooked up like through it was an option on the Haas. So it's connected to the compress. Like we have one, hose connection to the Haas and that's feeding the tool changer and the air blast and the spindle.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have that like automatic air gun thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, sweet.
It is pretty tight. But the one thing about it is, you know, you have to change the direction, the angle of it, rather, and the depth of it by manually. It's got like a quick release, like a bike tire.
Okay.
And we use really tiny short tools and then like some reasonably long, bigger tools. So, you know, we haven't found the sweet spot yet, I would say.
Well, you're going about it all wrong. There is actually a trick to this. You buy holders of different gauge lengths to get all of your tools so that the, you know, the cutting point of the tool is about the same between all of them.
Well, then I'd have some really long gauge lengths for some small tools.
Yeah, which is fine because those little tools aren't going to be, you know, taking much of a cut.
Interesting.
Yeah, so you get like a little EO 16 collet holder, you know, 2.5 inch gauge length or 3 inch gauge length or whatever, and then.
Well, why didn't you tell me this when you knew I was buying it?
Well, I didn't all know my you tool were having holders. This problem, buddy. I didn't know you were having.
Neither
this
did
problem.
I?
Yeah,
it's actually hasn't been bad, but it could be better.
Right. So one thing you can do if this is a problem and you don't want to buy all new holders, You can buy ER collet like straight shank extensions. Right? So then you'd be holding a collet in a collet.
Oh, but that sounds like you're the opposite of what a machinist would recommend doing.
No, you got to do the, you know, like if you're trying to optimize for something, then you optimize for it, you know.
But those are actually
quite
inexpensive. All about the shortest gauge length possible. Shortest stick out. Shortest
100%. But you are using like a 1/16th end mill to cut fret slots in wood. So I don't think you're going to like overload your spindle.
No, definitely not worried about overloading the spindle. Sometimes I look at the spindle, like the load meter or whatever, mm-hmm. and it looks very happy.
It's just zero.
Yeah. It's honestly, sometimes it's like the spindle load looks like it's jumping when it's like doing rapids or something.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, on my machine, pretty much the only time I ever see the load meter go above like literally zero is when it's accelerating or decelerating. So when the spindle's ramping up to speed or slowing down, and the whole rest of the time, like all of my cuts, even hard milling, they're all less than 1 horsepower, and that like doesn't even show up on the load meter.
Right. Crazy. I don't think we're pushing this thing too hard either.
Yeah. I mean, the people that really push their machines are people that are doing like production jobs in aluminum.
Oh, okay.
Because you can use as much RPM as you want in aluminum, right? As long as you have the coolant for it. So you'll end up taking like, you know, a 15 horsepower cut with like a face mill or something, or right. like a big insert end mill, or, you know, I think those are the guys that are using a ton of horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't do that. So
just itty bitty baby cuts.
Mm-hmm. I did have a very interesting conversation today with a machine tool rep.
Oh, what?
And yeah.
Oh God, I'm expecting
money.
Good moves, or good news rather.
I don't know. I don't
big
know yet.
Moves.
Big. It is definitely a big move. So I've been thinking for the longest time. I mean, we've talked about this so many times over the years. Wire EDM would be a very good thing for me.
That's not where I thought you were going.
I thought I was going with a big fancy mill.
Yeah.
So like a big fancy mill would be really nice, but it doesn't fundamentally change how I make my knives. It just makes the same process a bit shinier. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If I got a wire EDM, then the thing that it enables me to do is to machine all of the three-dimensional features on one side of the knife while it's still like in a rectangular piece of steel, flip it, machine all of the 3D features on the other side, but leave it in the block of steel, and then put it on the wire EDM and just cut it out.
Right.
And that's like a non-contact machining process. So the fixturing is very, very minimal. You can literally like, you know, put some little paper clips on there to hold it in place and then off you go.
Work hold in wire EDM?
They have like specialist vices and all sorts of like angle plates and stuff. Like basically everything is stainless because the deionized water is quite corrosive. So like wire EDM work holding is actually like sky's the limit for pricing. It's pretty nuts.
Oh really?
Yeah. But for me, I'd be holding everything flat. The wire EDMs normally have imagine a rectangular bar that goes around the outside of the machining area. And that's what they call their table. It's actually like hollow. It doesn't have anything in the middle.
Right.
And that is like covered in bolt holes and like dowel holes and stuff. So you can literally just bolt stuff down to that.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't have
it's
to
like
be
a fixture plate.
Fancy. Yeah. You know, so imagine, you know, I've got this like rectangular piece of steel that has all of the blade bevel and everything machined in on both sides, but it's not cut out. I've roughed the holes for the pins undersize, and I've made like a starting hole for the profile cut. I can pretty much all modern wire EDMs do automatic wire threading. So they'll actually thread the wire through the part if you already have a hole. So I can thread through the pinholes, come in and skim the pinholes to like perfect size within like 2 microns.
Right.
And then in the same operation, cut the profile. So now my tolerance between the, those pinholes and the outside profile is going to be accurate to within like a couple of microns without me even trying. You know, like it's kind of hard to like hold a sloppy tolerance on a wire EVM, you know? And that's by far like my most difficult tolerance. That's always the most difficult tolerance. And then everything else is a lot easier when I don't have to worry about work holding, because I'm you know, just bolting a flat plate down on the VMC and machining it.
Yeah. It's genius.
It would be by far the biggest single change I could make to my process.
okay, so what machine tool rep? What machine tool are you looking at?
So I went all the way to the top. I went straight to Makino.
Oh, wow.
To Makino
too. Yeah, you're a big Makino guy.
So they have a machine called the U3, which is their like smallest wire EDM. And I mean, it's still got a pretty decent work envelope. I think it's about like 26 inches wide and then 12. So yeah, 26 ish in X, 12 in Y. And then it can cut parts that are like 10 inches thick.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
So 10 inches thick?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy. This thing's cool looking.
Yeah, they're like really tidy little machines. Like,
they're not very big.
No, but that thing weighs like 5 metric tons. Like, it is an incredibly heavy little machine.
Really?
Yeah. And the rep was saying that, you know, his kind of off the cuff estimate is that cycle time for cutting out the kitchen knife would be 20 to 30 minutes.
Okay.
And consumables cost would be probably $5 to $6 an hour for that kind of a cut.
Right.
So that means I'm at a cost of like, you know, $2 to cut the knife.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, I've heard wire EDMs can be expensive to operate.
Yeah. And I think that they are, you know, but it's mostly if you're like taking, you know, cutting big, thick pieces.
Right.
He said, you know, he was basically advising me against going for any of the like fast cutting upgrades, because what I'm looking at doing is so easy for an EDM that I wouldn't get the extra benefit.
Right. Oh, cool.
Well,
that's sweet, so that you wouldn't, you know, you're not buying a machine that you're pushing its upper limits.
Yeah, not at all. And it would enable me to do a lot of really interesting stuff. Like, there's a feature on some knives called jimping, which is where you have like almost like little slots going across the spine of the knife as kind of a grip feature.
Okay.
They're really difficult to machine. Like, you'd have to like drill them beforehand and then mill through like halfway through the drill holes. You know, with a wire EDM, you can just make like a little tiny kind of like comb, you know, the wire can just go in and make those little slots.
Right.
Do all sorts of really, really interesting stuff. Like, I'm working on a folding knife design, right? Mm-hmm. I could do all of the handle parts and like the pocket clip and everything out of one piece of steel and then cut it out like a little, almost like one of those old plastic model plane kits where you like break the parts.
Yeah, you snap them out, yeah.
Yeah, you know, you just cut part them out with the wire EDM out of that one sheet of steel.
What a cool idea. Yeah, definitely a big zag. I wasn't expecting you to go this route.
But honestly, it's been something that I've been like really seriously thinking about for years, like literally years. The only reason I haven't jumped on it is that older wire EDMs tend to be money pits.
Oh, you need to buy new?
Yeah, new or newer. Like, you'd probably want something that's made in the last 10 years. I mean, if anyone's listening to this and knows of an older wire EDM that, you know, the parts are easily available, I would love to hear about it. You know, like, the electronics on the old ones, you know, like, they could be made out of, like, completely obsolete components.
Mm.
So, like, good luck getting replacement parts and stuff,
right?
You know?
Like a Fidal or a Haas, these are like a dime a dozen compared to a wire EDM, which is maybe a little bit more of a rare commodity.
Yeah. So, you know, I have seen some that are like, you know, you can find one on like Kijiji or Craigslist for like $5,000, but I really don't know what the maintenance would be like on something like that. Right. And I contacted another company today that sells like refurbished machines. And they have a 1997 Sodic A320, which I've heard is a relatively easy machine to maintain. But they want like $32,000 US for a machine from 1997.
97, holy smokes.
Yeah, you know, and a brand new Makino is 120. So like, is it, I don't know if it's really worth, you know, rolling the dice on the old one, you know?
Right, I mean, especially if you're going to finance it, like your deposit might be less than 30.
So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, honestly, the financial side of it is the most difficult part. If I buy a house and I'm able to move the workshop to the house, then, you know, like the numbers that I was doing on that house that I missed out on the other day, my fixed costs at the workshop would go from like $2,200 a month to like $600.
Right. Well, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, and that difference is like pretty much the financing on a brand new wire EDM.
Right.
Right.
And, what are the power requirements for this thing?
I'm waiting for the technical docs from the machine rep. But yeah, they kind of seem pretty beefy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like they need three phase. They're going to be on like, you know, 15, 20 amp breaker, something like that. So it's not too bad.
Yeah, that's
but
not
like,
crazy.
But in a residential setting.
Yeah,
you know, where well, you're going to have a single phase, it's going to be difficult.
That's always going to be a struggle.
Yeah. So we'll see. I'm going to talk to a bunch of different vendors. And then luckily we have CMTS coming up.
Yes. I'm so excited.
Yeah. So I'm definitely going to be like wire EDM shopping.
Cool.
At CMTS. We actually had some people write in. Scott Hoadley in particular said he's interested in coming out for a CMTS hang. So we should work out what day we're going and let everyone know so that we can hang out.
Right on. This is exciting. So who are the other players in the Wire EDM game?
It's Aggie Charmills, Brother, Makino, Sodic, and Fennec are the ones that I know of.
GF has one too, right? That would be pretty high end.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't think I've ever seen one of their machines. I know of the company because they do like crazy five-axis machines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, so like I could go with a better mill instead. But the thing that a better mill would get me is better surface finishes. It wouldn't fundamentally change my process. Whereas I think that a wire EDM, like going to that very different process has potentially a lot of benefits.
So could you like model this up, machine it as you've described, and then take it to a wire EDM job shop and say, cut this out.
Yes. And I actually had, there's a lovely guy named Marcus who runs a company on the West Coast in, he's actually on Victoria Island.
Oh, cool.
His company is called Implemex, and he does mainly, I'm giving him a shout out here because he's a super helpful guy on practical machines. He's always happy to answer questions and stuff. He does like super tiny, like he'll literally be like laser welding a part that like disappears on your fingertip, you know, like this, he does like really crazy medical applications. And I was talking to him about this, and he's actually offered to test cut some parts for me.
Oh, amazing.
On his older wire EDM. So yeah, I'm definitely going to take him up on that. It's just basically I have to get the kitchen knife process working at some level before I can, you know, do that.
But this would be how you would do your, you know, Resolute as well, right?
Yes, 100%. Because from the like VMC side, like the milling side of things, it means, so right now to do the Resolute, it's 5 operations. And if I was using this method, it would be 2 milling operations and 1 wire EDM operation.
Mm-hmm.
So that means I'd be able to go to much denser fixtures, much simpler fixtures. I would be a lot less picky about the condition of the raw materials. Like right now for the Resolute, I can only use precision ground stock.
Mm.
Because some of the finished surfaces are actually like the surface of the raw material.
Oh, like, really? Underneath
the handle scales, right? I can't machine that part because of the way my fixtures work. So I have to use precision ground stock. Whereas, doing this new method with the, you know, the first op would, I guess, be this tape and super glue. Second op is like, you know, held down by a bunch of bolts around the knife shape. I can access every surface. Yeah, and then, you know, one op on the wire EDM, and all of this could run unattended. You know, it means I'd be able to absolutely fill the machine table on the VMC, and, you know, maybe I would be looking at 16, 20 hours worth of unattended runtime.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And then, you know, I take all those parts, chuck them on the wire EDM, and then that runs unattended for 2 or 3 hours, and then I literally have, like, a wire EDM full of blades.
That's such a cool idea.
It's kind of funny how I came to this as well. Like, you know, obviously I've been thinking about it for a while, but one of the things that kind of kicked me into like really looking is, you know, we've talked a couple of times about like what I would do if I got a brand new machine. And one of the things I've always said is like, oh, it's super important that that machine is just running 24 hours a day doing hard milling. And then I was like, wait, why the fuck aren't I doing that now? You know, because so right now on the fixtures for the Resolute, on the left-hand side of the fixtures, there's all of the blade stuff. And then on the right-hand side of the fixture, there's an area for doing the handle scales. So if I'm running blades all the time, I don't have any capacity to do handle scales. Mm-hmm. And if I need to do handle scales, I have to interrupt the hard milling. And often that means that I'll miss, like, you know, the handle scales only take like 35 minutes. But that might mean that I miss out on like a whole cycle of hard milling. So I might miss out on 3 hours of spindle time for that half hour of handle scales.
Right.
And the handle scales are much more like on demand. Like I have to like assemble them and machine them on a you know, case by case basis for individual orders. Whereas the blades are, they're always the same. So I think I'm actually going to be moving toward that in as quickly as I can, like getting both the kitchen knife and the Resolute together, like the blades of them together on one set of fixtures in that machine that'll just run for as long as possible.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Would there be any limitations in terms of tool life or?
I think I would probably be at the point where I'm like, actually, you know what? I don't know. If I do the wire EDM route, then right now the thing that's killing my tools is cutting on the side of the tools, like cutting the profile of the knives.
Right.
Doing the 3D contouring on the bevels, the tool life's really good. You know, I might be looking at like 12 knives per tool for just the bevels.
So you're not going to run into an issue where you could swap out a tool before running a new palette, let's say.
Yeah, it would probably be like every 2 cycles, right, something like that, you know, and then I'd be getting, you know, 12 knives out of a tool. Something like that. So we'll see, man. Like, this is obviously, for me, this is would be a very aggressive move. I don't finance stuff. I don't go into debt as much as I can, you know.
Yeah.
And this would be like, you know, like a new wire EDM is a pretty big investment. So
right, it'd be a little scary to buy that before finding your new home, because
yeah,
the banks might know about that.
Yes.
If you financed $120,000.
Yeah, I think getting it afterward would make more sense.
Yeah.
For sure. Because as I said, you know, like if I'm able to get a place in the price range that we're looking at, then like literally I'll be saving enough money to just pay for the wider EDM and have my fixed expenses.
Right. You'll have more available money.
Cash flow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a very cool idea. I like that it's a non-traditional route.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's one of those things that, like, when you look at it, you're like, oh, if it works, like, I'm not going to toot my own horn too much before, like, proving it out. But, like, if it works the way I'd like it to, then it's going to be, like, magical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could potentially mean that, like, my fixtures become completely generic. Like, there's no fixture for the kitchen knife and the Resolute. There's just, like, one type of fixture.
Right.
You know, I buy one size of stock and I can just make whatever knife I want. That would be very, very cool.
What kind of surface finish does wire EDM leave?
It looks like a very fine kind of sandblasted finish.
Oh, okay.
Because the actual machining, it's really cool. Like at a large scale, when you look at it, it's, you know, very gentle, almost like no, it's basically a non-contact machining process. But at the microscopic scale, the machining is actually happening by like explosions that are like literally like as hot as the sun, just about, you know, like you've got these tiny little sparks happening between the wire and the workpiece,
right?
You know, underneath this like fluid bath. And when that spark happens, the amount of energy that it's injecting into that tiny little area, it's literally exploding and vaporizing the metal away.
That is so insane. Like,
yeah,
this tiny wire.
I know, right?
Like, how big is the wire?
The Makino rep recommended that I stick with 10/1000ths wire.
Oh my God, it's so thin.
And that's one of the thicker wires you would get. Like,
it's like a guitar string, the thinnest one.
Yeah. Yeah, the thickest commonly used wire is 16 thou, and they use that when they're doing like really thick cuts, mm-hmm. because the wire has to carry all of that energy.
Right.
So you actually need the extra diameter to be able to pass enough energy through it in order to keep making the cut.
So that finish that it leaves, would you have mm-hmm. to then, would you just leave it?
I would just leave it.
Oh,
you know, like sad. I'm already sandblasting
right.
most of my blade. So if I was to sandblast it, it's just going to blend in perfectly. But also I would really, really like to get to the point where my as machined finishes are so nice that I'm 100% happy sending them straight to a customer.
Like right off the machine.
Right off the machine.
Can you know, wire EDM the bevel?
Yes, you can. And no, it's not a good idea.
Okay. So you want your hard milled surface to be a mirror.
Yeah, you know, so imagine sometime in the fantastical future where I can afford, you know, like a Makino F5 hard milling mill, or like an Okuma Genos M560V, something like that, you know, where I'm just like making mirrors on the bevel. And right. then, you know, so the bevel is like an amazing mirror, and then the spine and the outline of the blade is this really cool like matte finish off the EDM.
Yeah, that would look so good.
Yeah.
Having that contrast is awesome. I mean, the majority of our guitars have a glossy top and a satin sides, mm-hmm. back and neck. And in that contrast looks great.
Yeah. And, you know, I would obviously offer like hand finishing options still, like satin finish, tumbled right. finishes, mirror polish, who knows, you know. But it would be so cool to have. That has for the longest time been my goal. And I've worked really hard to get to that, the idea of the finishes right off the machine being good enough that I could send them straight to a customer.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm just really up against the limits of my CNCs.
Right.
And the lengths that I've gone to get the finishes that I currently have are like pretty stupid, honestly. Like, so when I'm machining the bevels, everyone that looks at that, and this is what I used to do, it is a parallel 3D contour toolpath, right? Where the tool's just making straight lines back and forth, machining that whole surface.
Right.
The problem is that means that as you're going up the surface, the changes in elevation are always happening in straight lines. So you get this kind of like stair step thing that happens
right.
on my machine. So what I'm doing instead is actually a radial toolpath where you have like a center point, and then all of the passes of the tool are actually coming out from that center point.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, from like that tiny center point to a big outside circle. And I actually had to like do all this math and line it up so that the tool passes are lined up with the plunge line, and then they sweep out from there toward the tip, changing angle as they go. And that means that as you get toward the tip, it's actually starting to machine a curve across the bevel, and that eliminates the stair stepping because
sick.
You're going on a curve rather than straight lines up a ramp. But like that's such a pain in the ass to program, you know. So like a brand new machine like the Makino F5 would have no problem at all just doing a parallel finishing toolpath and not getting stair steps,
you know? Right.
So
how much is a Makino F5?
You know, You know what? I'm going to ask them because I don't actually know a hard number. I thought it was like closer to 200, but I also thought that the WireEDM would be more expensive than 120-ish for the U3. So we'll see.
Okumo lists their prices, don't they?
Yes, they do. The US prices, they list the like base price.
Right.
On their website. And I think it was like 130 for the M560. So, and like for anyone that's listening, like go check out like there's a YouTube video called the Dog Bone Demo on the M560V where they're cutting us, like they're doing a finish pass at 1,000 inches a minute.
Wow.
1 inch deep in steel.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Honestly, it's a stupid, stupid machine. It's pretty crazy.
This is a big machine though, the M560V.
Yes, it is. It's 16,000 pounds, 40x20 machining
area. Like, I would have thought you'd be looking at more at the M460.
So I just don't think it makes sense because there's only like a $10,000 difference between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you get an extra 10 inches of X travel. That means that I could like put more parts on there, get more unattended runtime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We wanted a VF4.
Right.
But we don't have the Z clearance.
Right. But so you mean you don't have the Z clearance in your workshop?
Yes.
Right? Like it would hit the roof.
Kind of.
If that wasn't an issue.
The pipes.
Oh, fuck those pipes.
If that wasn't an issue, it still would have been a bigger price tag. I mean, it's in. I actually don't regret buying the smaller machine because so far we haven't needed any more table space.
Right.
The idea was it would be a machine we could grow into more because we could machine a base neck on it.
Right.
But we're not making bases right now.
Right. Or you could have like one fixture plate that has locations for like all the different parts all on there at the same time. So you don't have to like swap fixtures out or something, right?
You could, but I mean, a guitar body is like 18 to 20 inches long. So right. Maybe you could fit two bodies on there and machine two bodies at once. But
no, I mean like one body, one neck, one fretboard, one.
Oh, you know, like wouldn't be big enough for that. Maybe a fretboard. You could do body and fretboard. Right. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, this one piece workflow is kind of working for us right now. It's definitely not the most efficient because you need to stand there, but we're not running these lights out. Yeah, I mean, our volume's just not there yet either, but
it will be. It will be.
Yeah. So the next one, that's what I'm saying. You save them. This is like, what's his name? Pierce, J. Pearson principle. It's like you kind of don't cheap out on it, get what you need, but don't like buy everything, every option on the machine.
Right.
You'll save $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. That's a deposit on another machine.
Right. Yeah. Well,
so 10 grand in your pocket. I mean, on a smaller machine it makes sense for you though. Cause you do load these, you could load that table with your small parts and just let it run.
Yeah,
exactly. Unattended.
Yeah, the ideal would be like 23 hours of cycle time or 47 hours of cycle time. Mm-hmm. You know, like I want it to be aligned just shy of a 24-hour boundary. So, you know, if I go in Monday morning, 9 a.m., the machine's done, and then I change out all the parts, hit cycle start, and then it's running until the next morning.
Yeah.
Or it's 2 days. You know, so like I can hit start Saturday morning, and then Monday morning it's ready. In terms of like running unattended and getting like the maximum out of that machine, it should be like as close as possible to 100% spindle on time. You know?
Right.
And yeah, running unattended, running lights out is like by far the best way to do that.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Yeah. And speaking of super cool and new machines, I got a message from Scott Hoadley, one of our listeners, who we've heard from quite a few times. Thank you, Scott, who sent me a photo of his bowler garage. Because he just got, you know, he was talking, I think you remember, right? He was talking about getting the Haas Mini Mill, and then we kind of talked him into a VF2.
Uh-huh.
So he bought it. It's in his garage.
Oh, way to
right
go,
next
Scott.
To his brand new Kayser screw compressor. Yeah, shop goals, dude. I'll have to ask him if I can post a photo, but it's ballin'.
You should ask him about how he got three-phase, or I guess probably a transformer.
Well, you know, a lot of Canada does have three-phase. Even
really?
Like rural Canada, yep.
Oh, sick. Well, congratulations, Scott. That's really dope. Mm-hmm. I want to know the specs. Sounds like a cool machine.
It does. And a couple of episodes ago, we were talking about cutting pick guards on a CO2 laser. I was asking you about that. So I heard back from Laura at Farm Chick Engraving, who she does a lot of like CO2 laser engraving and cutting. And she did some research for us and said that ABS can't be cut in a CO2 laser because it produces toxic smoke.
Excellent. So, good to know.
Bad idea. And initially she said that acetate couldn't be cut either, like the cellulose acetate, but with some extra research she said that it actually can be cut in a CO2 laser.
Okay.
Apparently the trick is low power, high speed, and multiple passes.
Interesting. Yeah, so that would keep it from combusting.
Yeah, I guess so, but the downside is if you do have a failure where it starts to combust, it's gonna really combust.
It doesn't, you know, it honestly doesn't seem as flammable as the celluloid nitrate.
Oh, okay.
But that's really good to know because, I mean, ABSs are probably the most common plastic we use for pick guards.
Right.
So won't be investing in a laser. Thank you.
Well, but maybe there's, you know, some other material that's equivalent, like a colored acrylic or something.
Yeah.
That is laser safe. Like acrylic is amazing on the laser. You get like glass finishes right on the edges.
Yeah, we used to make... You can't get nice white in acrylic, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's kind of milky, right?
Yeah, or just like appliance white.
Right.
Black looks great in acrylic, but you can't get multi laminate black. Mm. Like we use our black pick guards have a white and a black layer,
right,
underneath that black surface. But when we do just straight black guards, we use straight black acrylic, and for our pickup rings we use cast black acrylic.
Cool.
But yeah, that would I still do want a laser.
Of course.
What was her handle on Instagram?
I'll have to send it to you. It's Laura, and her name is Laura, and she owns a company called Farm Chick Engraving. However, I think that her Instagram handle was Mama of Two Hooligans, if I remember correctly. But I don't think that was her like business Instagram.
Oh, okay. All right.
So yeah, well, I'll have to see if she has a business Instagram.
Cool.
And, post that.
That's great. Great.
I might have to edit out her personal Instagram.
Probably. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. We actually got I'm sorry, everybody. If you've been writing to me on Instagram or elsewhere asking questions, I just have been slammed. So I know that there was a bunch of people that have written in and I haven't responded to you. And I'm trying my best to do it now. So please send us questions and feedback. It's really appreciated. Actually, on that front, we were talking about SpaceX last week. And I said that I thought that SpaceX did most of their machining and stuff in-house. It turns out we actually have a listener named Tony who does machining for SpaceX, but he does not work at SpaceX.
That's very cool.
So there, SpaceX does farm out parts to job shops, and his company is one of them. And apparently they make multiple part numbers for both Starlink and SpaceX projects. And sometimes they make hundreds of parts in a week for SpaceX, which is cool as hell. So... yeah, if you work for a job shop and you do like make parts for SpaceX, obviously there's going to be stuff you can't tell us because you're probably under an NDA or ITAR restrictions or whatever. But like, send us photos, send us whatever information you're allowed to share. Send it to us. We want to see it.
We want to hear more about machines this. That shop is running. Or...
yeah, is it 5-axis work? Is it 3-axis work? Like, mm-hmm. how brutal is this? Is it like crazy tolerances or are they reasonable?
Right.
material certifications.
What materials,
like,
are they?
Yeah. We want to know. Nick specifically said to me last week that he wants to know more about the manufacturing in terms of the SpaceX stuff. So
that's what I'm more interested in.
Yeah, 100%. I did actually do some research trying to find like a more recent factory tour. The most recent SpaceX factory tour that I can find is like 10 years old.
Okay, because so. I remember seeing a tour. I don't know where it was, when it was, but it was Elon Musk walking through a factory, and he was pointing out Haas VMCs.
Right.
Yeah, like, I'm gonna so have. I was surprised. I was like, I thought they would have had like, you know, a more high end machine.
You know what?
Who like, knows what like, they were doing with them?
Well, I mean, as we were talking about last week, right? You're like, be smart, design your parts with reasonable tolerances, and
yeah,
you know, go.
And
go
Haas
nuts.
Makes like, nice machines. Yeah. What's it gonna take me to get you into Haas today?
I'm looking at Makino, sir.
Sorry.
Yeah. Tommy,
you're
going to
have a baller garage if you get a Makino.
Dude, it's going to be so funny if I get a Makino, like high, you know, cutting edge Makino YADM, and then my shitty old Fidals next to it. Yeah.
That are just leaking oil onto your Makino.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Makino looks like a spaceship next to it. It's pretty funny stuff. Tommy Turbine on Instagram said, hey, any reasons why you're not looking at ShrinkFit? You can DIY, like ShrinkFit tool holders. You can DIY the heating, as you probably know. I have one, bought it for testing, and I'll probably buy several more. I've been very pleased. So, yeah, it's something I've been thinking about, but I haven't done it yet. What do you, have you looked at ShrinkFit at all?
Yes and no. I think it's cool. I've heard of, you know, people using blowtorches and even like rigging up something that like will spin the tool.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've heard it's not that bad. I've heard it can be annoying if you break a tool, but we don't really break tools. Mm. So it would be kind of sweet because it would take care of that issue we have with dust.
Yep.
I don't know. There's something. It just kind of scares me. I don't know why. I feel like I would be doing it wrong with the blowtorch. There's. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay, this is would not be an issue, but I have heard, and I just find this interesting. It wouldn't be an issue for me, rather, that ShrinkFit tool holders have a lifespan in terms of how many times you can heat them up.
Yes, I've heard something about that too, but I can't tell you off the top of my head whether it's true or false. I'd have
or
to
whether it's
look at it.
Hundreds or thousands of times.
Right.
But I find that interesting. Probably wouldn't be a problem for us, I would guess.
No,
but maybe so. I should. I mean, that's a good suggestion. Maybe we should be ShrinkFit.
Yeah. Maritool makes ShrinkFit, yeah.
They do make ShrinkFit, and they make a ShrinkFit machine.
Yeah.
But it doesn't
ShrinkFit machines are pricey.
Yeah, it doesn't have cooling, I think it was the one thing I heard about the Maritool one. But don't hold that to
well,
don't
I mean,
take my word
your
on
blowtorch
that.
Doesn't have cooling either, so you're just going to have to wait.
You just blow on it, right?
Give it a lick. Yeah, so I've been doing production hard milling with my hydraulic holders for a bit over a week now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and overall, I'm super happy. I think I'm running them a little bit hard.
Okay, you're pushing
on my side. Yeah, on my side milling operations, once the tool starts, because with hard milling, particularly when you're like using the side of the tool, you'll tend to take the cutting edge off, like it will chip at the cutting edge, but funnily enough it'll actually keep cutting really nicely. Because the hard steel doesn't smear, it just kind of gets sheared off, and that means that even if the tool is like partially destroyed, like chipped edges and stuff, it'll still keep cutting. And I've done that for a long time with like my ER25 collets. It is definitely a bit chirpy in the hydraulic holders once the edges start breaking down. It starts to sing me a song, which is not great. But I know from experience that with my current process, it's the same with ER holders. The one thing that I am a little concerned about is I'm starting to see some kind of vibration marks on the inside bore of the sleeve and of the hydraulic holder.
Oh, because wow.
clearly I'm like, you know, bouncing that tool around.
Is this part, like, part of the problem is your work holding?
Possibly. I mean, part of the problem is just my process,
right?
Basically. Yeah, it probably is work holding, because when I'm machining the side of the knife, I have to be clamping the knife from the top and bottom, so that it's kind of like a knife sandwich. The edge of the knife is sticking out the middle. But that means that I have to hang the tool out of the holder 5/8 of an inch. The flutes on the tool are only 3/8 long. Mm-hmm. So I have an extra 3/8 of shank sticking out that I don't actually need. And I'm sure if I shortened that up, it would be less chirpy. So, you know, maybe that's something that I need to do. I need to, like, bevel the edges on that work holding so that I can get
right
closer to the part.
Well, wouldn't a shrink fit help for that? Because the nose is so small as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
So you have a 1/4 inch of shank sticking out.
The shank is 1/4 inch in diameter. Yeah, I guess it's 1/4 inch. 1/4 inch-ish.
And what would you normally, you would put it right up to the flute, basically?
Yeah.
The end of the flute?
Yeah. So, yes, we'll see. I'm still obviously like, and I mean, this is part of the problem. Like, when I'm trying to machine the side of the blade, it forces me into a lot of like suboptimal solutions. Whereas if I only had to machine the 3D contours on either side, then I could like really choke up on those tools. They'd be really stubby.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the work holding would be like super, super solid, because I'd be like, for the kitchen knife, I redid a lot of the work holding today for the kitchen knife. I'm putting 16 1/4-20 socket head cap screws through the part into the fixture. So I'd be very surprised if that is chirpy. Yeah, so we'll see.
So how thick is the material you start with?
For the kitchen knife?
Yeah.
It is 1/8. 125 thousandths.
Really? It's quite thin. Millimeters.
Yep.
Wow. Okay, so you don't even, yeah, you don't even have that much like material that you're removing in terms of depth.
No. I mean, like,
because you're basically going to zero at the
edge is 10 thou thick.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the issues, is like I have to work out how to cut through and like get decent edge finishes.
Yeah. Know?
Which is, it's going to be pretty brutal. Like I think I might need a third operation. I'm not 100% sure. I have had really good luck so far cutting through. Basically what I do is on the first operation, I machine almost halfway through. I leave 10 thou of excess. And then on the second operation, I do kind of a ramp tool path going around and around until I've got like 20 thou of almost like a constant tab going around the part that's 20 thou thick. And then I do one pass that cuts through the full depth of the part and takes that tab off as well. And that means the part's always supported by the tab just in front of where the cut's happening.
Right.
And that is actually surprising. It works surprisingly well. Like the edge finish is pretty decent.
But it's hard on your tool.
It's hard on the tool. As soon as I get like a chip anywhere in that cutting edge, I'm just going to be leaving a stripe along the edge of the part that I'm then going to have to hand finish off. You know, so maybe I'll end up with an op 3 where I'm, you know, somehow clamping the blade down, and then I can come in with another end mill and make multiple passes around the edge to like clean it up. But again, wire EDM would make this not a problem.
I think it's a pretty slick solution.
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. I don't know.
It'll be really interesting to see how a test operation goes.
Yeah. I mean, the Makino rep said that he knows of other people doing similar stuff and that it works really well. And that it's, you know, I mean, if the operating cost and the cycle time is, you know, in the ballpark of what he was talking about, then it's literally going to be cheaper per part for me to do that on the WireEDM than it is to do it on the VMC, because right. I'm using more tools on the VMC.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm going through more tools.
I mean, think about it. It's like, this is what a WireEDM EDM is for, is...
Yeah. Making those little cuts. You know?
Yeah. So, okay, if the wire's 10 thou, what's the kerf it's leaving, like the
what's the size? It is a little bit bigger than the wire, but I don't know exactly what it is. It's, you know, a bit bigger than the wire, but not right. much, like probably like a thousandth or two, you know?
Oh, okay. Wow, man, so cool. What a crazy technology. Who the hell came up with that?
I know, right? We're over time again, buddy. We haven't even talked about space.
Well, we've mentioned it
briefly. We've still got a couple of people that have written in with questions and suggestions and stuff, so we'll have to get to those next week. But oh man, time just flies by.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll just get back to it next week.
Yeah, absolutely. We're gonna have more space stuff to talk about. We will decide between now and next week when we're gonna go to CMTS.
Yeah,
so that we can put the word out and get an XYZ gang at CMTS.
Sounds fun.
We can roll up on John Grimsmo and throw down.
Who else can we roll up on? Because I mean, if we've got all these, if we've got this gang, you want to take, you know, a posse. You want to take advantage of that.
Yeah, yeah. No,
maybe I think, an old bully.
Well, yeah, I think we'll probably just meld with John's gang, because I'm pretty sure he and Angelo and Eric and Sky will all be there. So
I don't know if I want to hang with you guys. You guys all have knives.
Yeah, that's true. I'm always like whipping them out.
Yeah, do knife tricks and stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll talk to everybody next week. We'll arrange a CMTS hang, and yeah, hope everyone has a great week.
Remind me of the dates.
Dunno.
Oh, okay.
Let's talk about it next week.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, buddy. Yeah, I will. Hope everyone has an awesome week, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt. A classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA, so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.